Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and it's Friday, so let's dive right into our week in review, starting with a look at the state of the Democratic Party in the wake of Donald Trump's upset victory last week. With us in the studio today, Jabari Asim, executive editor of The Crisis, the Journal of the NAACP, and a professor of creative writing at Emerson College. And Jabari, welcome back to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Tom, good to see you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's pick up with what we heard Congresswoman Catherine Clark talking about. We were talking about how Democrats are talking about leadership votes in the House. Several members of Congress, including Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, led a kind of revolt to delay the vote until after Thanksgiving. This week, Seth Moulton told WBUR that the party needs time to figure out how to respond to last week's election. Here's what he said.
If we want to move forward and have a chance of doing better in elections in the future, we've got to do some soul searching. We've got to do some listening. We've got to do some strategizing. We've got to do a lot of things differently because clearly the American people said the status quo is unacceptable.
So Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan says he wants to challenge Nancy Pelosi to become minority leader. He says Democrats keep losing and they need to reach working class folks, the kind of folks that Trump was able to appeal to during this election. Now, in the last segment, we heard Congresswoman Catherine Clark say she will support Nancy Pelosi. We heard the same thing yesterday from Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas. So, Tom, I'll start with you. What's the significance of this debate, this delay in Congress led by the likes of Seth Moulton? Is it going to take the Democrats anywhere?
I certainly like what Seth Moulton's doing here, but I'm not sure it's going to take him anywhere. Right now, it strikes me that a bomb went off a week and a half ago, and the Democrats are still in the fallout shelter and have not come out. And they're almost timid about it. They know there's something wrong. They really are flailing about trying to figure out why it is that a party that, you know, quite frankly, 10 years ago, I remember writing that demographics favored the Democratic Party in the future. But it seems like the future never becomes the present. And instead, this party has been steadily losing state houses. It's been losing the legislature. It's now lost the presidency. And it's become very much almost a regional party as opposed to a national party.
Yeah, regional, maybe a bi-regional party.
A bi-regional, right? Yeah, two regions. And you know, basically the two coasts. And that is about it. And I do think that Moulton is right that some very serious soul searching has to occur. What's distressing about the interview we just heard is I don't hear it coming from other members of Congress.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. What do you think, Jabari? What's the way forward for the Democrats here? And I mean, one of the questions I could ask, you know, is Nancy Pelosi the leader in Congress, at least for the minority, for the foreseeable future?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, Tom talked about them being timid in their reaction, because that is the long-term criticism of Democrats and liberals in general, that they're too timid to confront the issues, to confront the opposition. And it is sort of ironic that they're not signaling a new direction with the hesitant way they're sort of coming out of the box. I think the odds are very much in Pelosi's favor to hold on to her seat. But it raises interesting questions about changes that may need to take place. Moulton talked about the need to listen and to strategize. And I think there's going to have to be some emphasis on what exactly that means.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what does that? What do you think that? What does that mean, Tom?
Well, I one of the questions you asked of Catherine Clark had been about the seniority system.
Yeah,
and she evaded really answering that question. There's no question in my mind that you need to get rid of it. The Republicans have, you know, whether you agree with them or not, the Republicans have a lot of blood that really comes up very quickly and nationalizes itself. People who just enter the party, just are elected, and all of a sudden they're in senior positions. That doesn't happen on the Democratic side.
Yeah, I think
the
seniority system among the Democrats, now I'm going to get this wrong, but it's something like this. The average age of the Democratic leader in the Democratic caucus is late 60s, mid 70s, somewhere in there, really, really high. So someone like Seth Moulton comes into Congress, who I really get the feeling wants to move the party in a new direction. What hope does someone like that have to sort of move up quickly in the party leadership structure?
Not right now, not much of a chance.
Yeah. So you mentioned this, Tom. Republicans now control both houses of Congress, the White House, 33 governorships, a majority of state legislatures, more than at any time in the history of the GOP. And I just came across this fact. I'm going to ask both of you guys, put you on the spot. Guess how many states have a Democratic governor and a Democratic state legislature?
Okay, I feel like I'm having an Aleppo moment here.
First, tell me how many states there are. No, I'm
kidding. I'll tell you. There are five. Five wow. states left. Rhode Island, Connecticut, Oregon, California, and Hawaii. They're
wow.
the only five yeah. states that are still entirely controlled by Democrats. So, so I guess the final question is, why are the Democrats in the political wilderness like this? Let me ask you, Jabari.
Well, even when their message is a valid and compelling message, they seem to have they have a lot of problems in getting that to the people.
Yep.
Right? So, for example, when we say that the Democrats didn't necessarily demonstrate that they had an interest in working class concerns, you know, there are parts of the platform, there are parts of the party that very much have those concerns. But they didn't seem to do a good job conveying that. So on the national level, the presidential campaign, it did create this appearance of vulnerability in terms of being tone deaf, in terms of being distant from the concerns of working class people. I would argue that the platform and some of the advisors actually did have those things in mind, but somehow something was lost in translation
yeah.
between the podium and the people.
All right, last question about this, and I'll put it to you, Tom. Is it a question of message or messenger or the wrong policy?
So I think it is a question of attitude. Hmm. There is someone I think described the Democratic Party as now becoming the party of the PhDs. And there is this sense that you have an elite, maybe academically elite, that doesn't understand those who may not have the same pedigrees and kind of talks down to them. And I've heard that a lot in oftentimes the circles I travel in, which, in Massachusetts, it's all Democrats. And there really is this lack of understanding about the folks on the other side. And I do think it's not only the Democratic Party, by the way. It is also the media as well, mm-hmm. and failing to understand the whole Trump phenomenon and how Trump was connecting. This is a really big problem that you have in almost two Americas, in a very different two America sense than was previously thought of, but two Americas, kind of an urban elite versus the rest of the country.
So I'm glad you brought this up, because it actually provides a perfect sort of transition to the next thing that I wanted to talk about. And this is sort of what we could call, might be called, the reddening of a blue state here in Massachusetts. Now, obviously, Massachusetts voted for Hillary Clinton, but parts of the state voted very heavily for Donald Trump. This week, the Boston Globe looked at this. It found that the same working class voters who allowed Trump to flip states in the Midwest from blue to red also turned out in Massachusetts in high numbers, and in particular in the state's western counties, where a handful of towns flipped from Democrat to Republican. I was in Fall River this week, which is still a sort of Democratic stronghold. It voted for Clinton. But at the same time, it saw a 50% increase in Republican ballots compared to the election 4 years ago. So, Jabari, are we seeing a reddening of Massachusetts, or what do you think about this?
Well, I think it's as much a matter of voting against the Democratic candidate as voting for the mm-hmm. Republican candidate. Mm-hmm. I think we do have to acknowledge that the charisma factor, not that you could make an argument that Trump is not necessarily a charismatic figure, but there is a contrast in the way that the two candidates brought their messages to people in terms of getting a reaction of any kind. For people, even getting a strong hostile reaction in some ways is a positive thing, because it's clear people have a perception of what it is you have to say. And in some of that journalism that I saw in investigating that reddening in Massachusetts, there did seem to be this sentiment that I was not excited by the Democratic candidate.
Yeah. What do you see, Tom, in this idea of the reddening of Massachusetts?
So I'm not sure I buy it as a reddening. I think it's a Trumpization.
Okay. Distinction.
And it really is, because Donald Trump is not a traditional conservative Republican. Donald Trump was bringing a message of change. He was clearly an imperfect messenger of change, but he had that very powerful message that he was against the establishment, he was against the elites, he represented the more common people. So when you see what happened in Massachusetts, you'll see that some traditionally Republican areas, like the wealthy suburbs of Boston, actually went for Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. while it is some very blue-collar areas that traditionally support Democrats that went for Trump. I don't think it's about the GOP. I think it's about economics.
That's interesting. Well, let's hear a little tape on this. Our WBUR's Fred Tice went to Saugus last week. It went for Obama 4 years ago, this year for Trump. Fred talked to one voter, Steve Petkovich, who explained why he voted for Trump. Here's what he said.
We're overpopulated. You keep letting people in this country, you got to draw the line somewhere. It's not even the Latinos. I mean, they're hard workers. You just can't let people into this country without going through the legal system or, you know, doing it the right way. It's not fair to the people that did it the right way. All he wants to do is get rid of the criminals. He doesn't want to send people back that have kids here. That's not going to happen.
So there's a voter in Saugus, Steve Petkovich, talking about one of the reasons why he voted for Donald Trump, this fear over illegal immigration. Jabari, what did you hear in that?
Well, one thing I was curious, he said, is it's not the Latinos. Then I wondered who exactly this targeted other was that he was responding to. I'd like to see some clarification there. That was particularly confusing. And it reminds me of the comedian Dave Chappelle saying, you know, we're talking as if we want to pick our own strawberries, some of these people. People, right? And so, the manufacturing jobs aren't coming back. We've converted to a service economy, if that. And it's hard to see how even Trump has articulated the role that let's say, reforming trade policy would play in actually bringing manufacturing back to the Rust Belt.
Yeah. Interesting. Tom?
So it was interesting to hear that. It's the illegals that bother him. Well, there's a really simple solution to that, of course. Reform the immigration laws to make it easier to come into this country legally. But that's not what people want here. This is not about the so-called illegals. This is about immigrants coming in who really don't look like the rest of America.
I want to ask what you think Trump's victory means for our Republican governor, Charlie Baker. Baker did not support Trump, and he said that he left the presidential ballot blank. The reason I want to ask this, I've spoken to a few hardcore Trump supporters in this state who say they're angry at Baker for this. And I'm just wondering if this puts him in a tough spot with part of the Republican base. What do you think, Tom?
So I think it does put him in a tough part with part of the Republican base, but I don't think he's going to end up facing a very serious primary challenge. I think any challenge he faces a couple of years from now, he's going to be able to meet that challenge, and he'll be the nominee again if he wants, in fact, to run again. I do think it's going to be interesting to see how Massachusetts relates to the White House. There might be a good sign there in terms of what might be going on this weekend with Trump meeting with Romney. And perhaps you'll just see that bridges can be mended despite out of Romney, the harshest rhetoric we ever heard against Trump. So maybe Charlie Baker has a chance in sort of that patching up as well.
I want to talk about the Romney thing a little bit later, but let's stick with this idea about what a Trump presidency might mean to Massachusetts. So this week, Charlie Baker was asked about Trump's campaign pledge to defund sanctuary cities, which include Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, among others. And basically a sanctuary city, a loose definition, I guess, is a city that doesn't cooperate with federal efforts to identify or deport undocumented immigrants. Here's what Baker said.
We're a global community. We're a global commonwealth. People need to feel welcome here. And I can tell you point blank as governor that I will continue to work with my colleagues in state and local government and with others to ensure that everybody feels welcome here in the Commonwealth of Mass. And we will not tolerate acts of violence against anyone.
Jabari, is Baker in a tough spot here, or what's your view about this idea that Tom brought up, his relationship with a Trump administration?
Well, two things. Trump is punitive and petty. So on the executive level, he's probably is going to run into some problems. But in terms of speaking out against Trump's policy towards sanctuary cities, Baker's going to be part of a company of like-minded public officials that are already making those kind of comments. Mm-hmm. For example, the nation's largest police union endorsed Trump, but police chiefs around the country are already saying, we're not going to cooperate with that particular policy. So I think there Baker won't be alone, and there'll be strength in numbers.
I'm really curious about this, finally, before we leave the sort of Charlie Baker question. He represents a kind of disappearing breed of moderate Northeastern Republicans. Does this sort of brand of moderate Baker-style Republicanism have a future in the land of Trump? We'll start with you. I mean, in the age of Trump, Tom Keene?
So prior to the most recent election cycle, everyone thought that there really could be a resurgence. That was the whole GOP rethinking after Romney's loss to Obama, that you really needed to reach out and start to appeal to new demographic groups. I think that rethinking is on the table at this point, and no one's going to be paying attention to it. I think that the message out of Trump's election for a lot of people is going to be that you need to appeal to people the way that Trump appealed to people, and that will not be the way Charlie Baker, very admirably in that clip, was really reaching out to the dispossessed and saying that he's going to treat them fairly. That's not going to be the Republican Party we're going to hear across the nation.
Hmm. Do you agree with that, Jabari?
Yeah, I think it comes down to image management. You know, for example, you know, we're talking about how the Democrats come off as, say, professorial, when at the elite level, the Republicans are equally professorial, if we can be generous and call Newt Gingrich a former professor. So we have that degree of educated elite, but somehow they come off differently, despite having very similar backgrounds.
I'd love to talk briefly with you guys about the future Trump administration and how it's taking shape. We learned today that he's picked Lieutenant General Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, and Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo as CIA Director. So let's start with Sessions. Here he is back in February when he endorsed Donald Trump at a rally in Huntsville, Alabama.
You have asked for 30 years, and politicians have promised for 30 years to fix illegal immigration. Have they done it?
No.
Donald Trump will do it.
Yeah.
All right, so that's Jeff Sessions announced today to be Donald Trump's choice as Attorney General. We should note that in 1986, a Senate committee denied Sessions a federal judgeship because former colleagues testified that he used the N-word and joked about the KKK. Let me start with that. Thoughts about Sessions or all three of these folks about what it says about the coming Trump administration, Jabari?
Well, I'm going to echo Catherine Clark. He said he was going to unite the whole country, but these four appointments do anything but. I know in the African-American community, Bannon and Sessions in particular are repugnant choices. It's hard to imagine a worse choice than Jeff Sessions. So I think we're still looking for that conciliatory gesture around the country. We're not seeing it so far.
Yeah, what are you seeing, Tom, in these early days?
So right after the election, a lot of people kind of viewed Donald Trump like an inkblot, you know, looking at him and trying to figure out, well, is he a pragmatist? Could he really be a liberal in conservative clothes? Could he be conservative? What's he really going to be all about? I think these three picks right here are very hardcore conservative picks, and they're at least telling us that at this moment, Donald Trump is going after and trying to shore up his conservative base. And that's absolutely what these folks are. I actually think they'll end up getting approved by the Senate. Sessions has made a lot of friends in the 30 years since and probably is actually pretty well liked within the Senate. What will be interesting to see with Trump is whether this is it and then he starts going to more moderate figures for his other cabinet appointments. And that might be a possibility. I mean, I do think Trump's going to be all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And he is going to you'll be able to read into him what you want to read into him. But at this point, he's conservative.
Yeah. And in that regard, you brought up the name Mitt Romney, former Massachusetts governor. He's going to be meeting with Donald Trump this weekend. There's talk that he might be under consideration for Secretary of State. This just makes my head spin because don't forget, Mitt Romney's the guy who called Donald Trump a phony, a fraud. Donald Trump referred to him as you know, one of the biggest losers for losing the last election. What do you think about this, Jabari? And I mean, what's the significance of Mitt Romney meeting with Donald Trump? And do you think he could end up with a cabinet position?
Yeah, I think it's sort of like what Tom said. It's a gesture toward the center, if we can cut it with.
Yeah.
If we're looking at a sliding scale, then Romney is centrist compared to some of these people. And it also kind of borrows from the whole team of rivals concept, right? That I can be so presidential and such a chief executive that I can entertain opposing opinions from different people who advise me. So I think part of that idea is also animating these gestures.
Yeah. What do you think about the Mitt Romney thing, Tom?
Well, of course, it's reminiscent of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, right, where they ran against each other, sometimes very harsh rhetoric back and forth, and yet Barack Obama names Hillary Clinton Secretary of State. The rumor out there is that Romney will be up for Secretary of State as well, which I think actually would be a terrific move if that actually happens.
Would that sort of signal that so Trump can sort of go both ways, hardcore conservative, but he's also prepared to be
right
a little more moderate? Yeah,
right. I mean, the thing about Donald Trump, it's always struck me, is that the man is unprincipled, and I mean that in the sense that there are no hard driving ideological principles behind what he does. He is a pragmatist who figured out how to get elected, and And right now he's figuring out he needs to sop to his conservative base, but he's also, I think, going to all be reaching out and having to pull other people into his orbit because he wants to be able to effectively govern. And you can't effectively govern with such a narrow margin as he has right now.
Mm. All right. Well, we've got just enough time left here for our hubbubs, those brief stories that caught our attention, maybe fell below the fold, didn't make the front page. Jabari, let me start with you. What's your hubbub this week?
It's the National Book Awards. I mean, part of it is, you know, I'm partial to books, and I remember all the attention the Oscars got when the winners and the nominees weren't particularly diverse. National Book Awards does a much better job, and the winners were a very diverse lot, and I would like to have seen more attention directed to that.
So, well, then enlighten us. Give us one or two of the picks that excited you.
Colson Whitehead won for Fiction for The Underground Railroad. Ibrahim Kendi won for Stamped from the Beginning for Nonfiction. And Congressman John Lewis also won for the Best Book for Young Readers. So, you know, it's a pretty diverse bunch and indicative of other places in popular culture. You know, movies could be that diverse. Plays could be that diverse. I think that books are setting the example, and I'd like to see publishing, at least the awards part of publishing, get more of a pat on the back for that.
All right. Tom, yeah. Your hubbub.
So there was another election this week, one that was also filled with controversy, one that pitted the East Coast against the Midwest, one that was beset with charges of fraud and vote rigging. I refer, of course, to the selection of Red Sox pitcher Rick Porcello for the American League Cy Young Award. Detroit's Justin Verlander actually received more first-place votes than did Porcello, but shades of the Electoral College. The rules of the Baseball Writers Association of America are complicated, and lo and behold, Porcello ended up the winner. Midwesterners are furious. New Englanders, of course, are delighted. This particular election got me thinking about why we so love sports. People argue, tempers flare, sides are taken, passions run deep. Everyone's a critic, everyone has an opinion, and the battles can almost seem like death matches. But at the end of the day, and unlike a certain other election, people aren't deported, no one loses their human rights, and the earth itself is not imperiled. That's the beauty of sports and why we embrace it. It's got all of the mishigas without any of the consequences.
All right, well said. So my hubbub is related to sports as well, and it's that finally, at long last, we get to hear Patriot quarterback Tom Brady sound off and express his frustration about Deflategate, the overblown, so to speak, scandal about underinflated footballs that led to a four-game suspension, which is another term for a vacation on the Riviera for Tom Brady. So it comes in a new commercial for the Foot Locker, specifically for the Foot Locker's so-called Week of Greatness, in which a pair of teens question how Foot Locker has managed to sustain its success for so long. Brady overhears their doubts and sounds off. Here's what he says.
Kind of makes you wonder what Foot Locker's up to.
You know, that's an unfortunate mindset you got there.
Tom Brady.
Just because something's great year after year doesn't mean anything's going on. Why can't some things just be great?
Just a question.
It starts with questions, and then questions turn into assumptions, and then assumptions turn into vacations. So why would you punish the Week of Greatness for something that never even happened? I lost my appetite.
So there's Tom Brady.
That's great.
You know, I think he's on his way to an acting career after his football career ends.
Another
10 years from now. But Jabari Yassim, executive editor of The Crisis and the Journal for the NAACP and a professor of creative writing at Emerson College, thanks for coming in. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor. He's a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Tom, thank you as well.
It was a pleasure.
Stay with us, listeners. Coming up, new music and reflection from Mehmet Ali Sanlikal and his jazz ensemble, What's Next? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.